In episode 65 of MobyCast, Chris walks us through the setup of his personal blog using Ghost. Welcome to MobyCast, a weekly conversation about cloud-native development, AWS, and building distributed systems. Let's jump right in.
Welcome, Chris and Rich. It's another episode of MobyCast.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
All right. So this week, we're going to talk about, I guess, so in deciding this week's topic, Chris has been doing some work on his personal blog, and it's like, your personal blog. But the thing is, Chris is hosting his own personal blog in a way that nobody in their right mind does. And I think you're kind of doing it because it gives you a chance to, you know, do what you want in AWS, and it's kind of a learning tool to make sure that you're good to go on new services and changes inside of AWS, and gives you some tricky stuff to play with instead of just going on like WordPress.com and buying their blog hosting package. Am I right? Or is it also that you have some specific data ownership concerns and you want to make sure you're in charge of your own database of your own blog, or a little bit of both?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Probably first and foremost, just glutton for punishment, do things the hard way. Mm-hmm. But then also just having the option for complete total control and flexibility over whatever it is that I want to do with it.
Right on. And it turns out that option involves lots of software operations work, or DevOps work, or whatever you want to call it these days. It involves a lot of SRE work.
Yeah, it's kind of, and we'll get into this, but it's kind of amazing. Like, you know, hosting, like, so at the end of the day, yeah, it's hosting a personal blog, but the amount of work and kind of like the amount of surface area that kind of this is touched is pretty breathtaking. And so it's been fun in its own right, just for that alone.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. A personal blog is a web application, and there's no limit to what you can do in terms of making that web application distributed and reliable and available and all those other things. And I'm hoping also, Rich, to kind of get your take on a couple of things during this conversation, because, you know, you offer development services for WordPress. You are not hosting people's personal blogs, but WordPress, there's some overlap between WordPress and people's personal blogs. It kind of grew out of that space into two-thirds of the internet. So yeah, we'll get your take on a couple of things as we get into it. So to start out, maybe you could just kind of give us an overview of, you know, the decisions you made, Chris, at the beginning when you decided, hey, I'm going to make a little blog and I'm going to host it myself.
Yeah, so this process started about 3 or 4 years ago. And so I just, you know, like just about everyone else, like, oh, I should have my own personal blog and have grand aspirations, right, for the weekly blog posting and thousands upon thousands of followers and all the kudos and the claps and everything. And so, you know, and of course, you know, being a tech guy, it's like doing the, you know, going and paying $9 a month or whatever it is to go have just some hosted service, right? And just type in my content, like that was too easy. I didn't want to do it that way. So let's do it the hard way. And of course, WordPress has been definitely popular and kind of like the de facto standard for blogs. But around that time, I heard about a tool called Ghost, and Ghost was a relative newcomer on the scene with lots of buzz around it. The thing that was probably really got me interested into the fact that it was a Node.js application. It was started as a Kickstarter, and by, I think, some of the people that were at WordPress or had worked on WordPress, but just kind of like it was had the feel of like, hey, we've learned a lot with, you know, CMS systems and kind of working with WordPress, like, Here's the things that we want to address now with Ghost. And so we're going to do this Kickstarter, and it's going to be open source, and it's just this really cool thing. And again, being a Node.js application, that caught my eye. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to use this Ghost thing. And so that's what started that process.
Cool. And so with Ghost, Rich, you know, you've been in the WordPress world for quite a while, and you were, you know, already deep in WordPress when Ghost came out. What was your thought about Ghost when it came out, and have you still been following it at all?
So I can't remember when it came out, but I'm guessing it was 5 years or more, right? Mm-hmm.
And I think the Kickstarter was in 2013.
Okay.
Yeah. Back then, I don't think that I didn't have a whole lot of interest in it then, because I felt like WordPress was still headed in the right direction. And I think that there was a lot that I could still learn from WordPress. Today's a little bit different because there's so many options that I'm starting to like look over, you know, the fence mm-hmm. and see what else is there. But I know a lot of people who were super excited about it and then came back to WordPress just because I guess it's like a lot of times, you know, in the early stages of those products, like they're great and fundamentally they're built in a way that's more modern, but at the same time, they don't have the rich feature set that they're accustomed to with WordPress. And so,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, WordPress being a platform, essentially, it means that it has a whole ecosystem of things that enrich it. What I'm just curious, you mentioned you're looking at a couple of things now. What are you looking at now that could dethrone WordPress in your world?
So the whole idea of the API first CMSs, mm-hmm. so you have this admin, but it basically just creates a bunch of endpoints and then it has no real consideration of what will be on the front end. That's really exciting.
Yeah, for sure.
That's where everything's headed. So Graph CMS, which uses GraphQL, Contentful, if you have the money, Contentful starts at like $200 a month, but it provides these admin UIs that give you the ability to just on the fly create these endpoints and then do whatever you want with it. I think that's sort of where we would head if we were to leave. There are plenty of PHP like Craft CMS, which I think is on Symfony maybe, and Laravel has like their own version of a CMS. But I don't think that if we were to leave WordPress, we would stick with PHP. You know,
it makes sense. Probably a good idea.
Yeah.
All right, so you're going to host this thing, Chris, and how are you going to host it at this point? You're already looking at AWS quite a bit, so what did you decide to do?
Yeah, I mean, this is like 3 or 4 years ago, and by then I'd been using AWS for quite some time. So hosting this on AWS was definitely going to happen, and then also Docker as well. So going to Dockerize this and run it within AWS. So the first thing I had to do was just, there was actually a Docker image for Ghost, although it was definitely a bit rough around the edges. And it took some effort to kind of get that in a shape that was kind of had the functionality that I needed. So I had things like dealing with secrets for, you know, for database credentials or for mail service credentials. Also things like logging and various other things. So I had to take that base Docker image and then customize it, extend it, make my own custom Docker image from it. And then once that's done, then go ahead and host that on ECS inside AWS.
I'm imagining that when you said secrets and mail host credentials and things like that maybe that the Docker image that you got, it just made some assumptions and just put those things where they shouldn't be. And you had to get them out and put them in a place where they could be read maybe off of S3 with keys or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was essentially left as an exercise to the reader. Okay. Right? Like the Docker image that they had was just kind of made some assumptions that like configuration was coming from a file actually, I think at that point it was a JavaScript file. So it's just expecting the JavaScript file to exist on the file system, and that's where the secrets are, and it just reads from that, right?
Right on. And so you have to go make that JavaScript file and then make sure not to put your secrets in it.
Yeah.
So exactly. It has to read them from somewhere else. Exactly. Got it. Okay, cool. All right. So you're running it in ECS. And I think, you know, from our notes here, I sometimes talk about our notes. It's no secret that we have to look at notes to have a conversation. It looks like you want to talk about is mostly sort of, you know, not the Dockerizing, not putting things on ECS, but really making the thing available via DNS and load balancing and things like that. So maybe we can go straight to that.
Yeah. So the process of Dockerizing Ghost and getting all this stuff to work, that was, you know, an effort in and of itself. But then the next thing I was faced with was, in addition to my own personal blog, right, I also actually had other things that I was hosting on ECS as well with their own DNS names. So things like, you know, some various microservices with RESTful APIs and wanting to host that. And so again, being kind of like, this is for my own personal interest, using my own, you know, personal AWS account, really cost was a huge factor here. And so I'm kind of thinking, okay, well, what am I going to do? I basically have like a handful of services that I want to be able to host on ECS, and I want to be able to address those by different DNS names. So how can I do this without having to spin up an ELB, Elastic Load Balancer, for each one of these DNS names? Because ULBs are not necessarily cheap, especially if you're paying for it, right? If it's coming out of your Starbucks money. So $20 a pop per month, you know, if you have five, that's $100 a month just on load balancers alone. So, and the other big caveat here too, is like, this is before AWS had announced or released ALBs, application load balancers, right? So really it was just the one load balancer type. It was classic load balancer. So things like host-based routing or path-based routing didn't exist at the load balancer at that point. And so thinking about this, I'm like, well, you know, how can I do this? And this is where it gets a little crazy, right? And like,
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. Before you get there, it's because I'm just trying to understand your architecture. I'm just trying to think, did you have multiple ECS clusters for each of your different projects that you had? Or were you trying to put, you know, these other APIs that you were talking about, these other microservices that you had for whatever other reason, and your blog wanting to reside as services within the same ECS cluster?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was all just a single ECS cluster, but multiple. Okay. There's an ECS service for each one of these things, right?
Yeah. So yeah, one cluster.
Yeah, you specify like a load balancer, right, for each one of your ECS mm-hmm. services that are fronted by a load balancer. So if I'd kind of just done it like the straightforward way, it would have been like, if I have five services, there'd be five ECS services and I'd have five load balancers, and then boom, I'd be done.
Just thinking that through, I'm still trying to get my head around that. The reason you would have five is because that load balancer is going to direct all traffic to that service. So for you to direct traffic to different services, you would need different load balancers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
And again, this with a classic load balancer, the way that it was dictated was you're going based upon a port, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. The world's a lot different now.
Sure.
But essentially it was like, you could, each one of these services, in order for them to coexist, they'd have to be listening on different ports. And so that was the mapping that was done at the load balancer to say, it's like, oh, when for this particular service, like, this is the port that it's listening on. So this is what you're forwarding to.
Right on. So you could have one load balancer go talk to many different services as long as those services were on different ports. Yes.
And so that's kind of where this went, right? So the idea was like, okay, well, I only want to have one load balancer. So how do I have one load balancer and have these five different services? So definitely one of the things I have to do there, right, is each one of these services has to be listening on a different port,
mm-hmm.
Right? And so I could do something like, I just tell, like, when you go to my blog, you go to the DNS name colon, like, you know, 8080, right? And when you want to hit this one other service, you go to colon 8081, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. Mm-hmm. That feels kind of bad, right?
Yeah.
Not so nice. So how can we, given like that's the underlying like mechanism, how this stuff works, like how can I kind of make this friendlier for people on the front end? And so what I ended up doing was basically using Nginx to do this mapping.
Yep.
And so essentially how it would work is that given one of these five services, all of them, their DNS would resolve to the same ELB, right? And then what would happen is the ELB would, and that would come in on obviously port 80 or port 443. That traffic would be forwarded to this custom app that was basically Nginx. And Nginx would then do the inspection of the headers to see, okay, what host were they trying to talk to? So they came in, you know, for the blog URL or for one of the service URLs, it would see that. And then based upon that, it would say, oh no, you want to go back to that load balancer, but now go on this port.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So Nginx would then basically loop them back around to the load balancer, but this time using the right to use the custom port that service was using.
Right.
When that happened, now the load balancer got it and it would actually forward it to the correct service in ECS. Yep.
Yeah, we've done this before. Akelsis did this on a project before. Also, I think because of the lack of ALBs and host-based routing. For the same type of reason, it was like some stuff coming in should go to this WordPress application and some other stuff should go to this, you know, node service. And Nginx is the one that can figure that out. And I can't remember off the top of my head. It's like what configuration file and what, you know, where you say to do this in Nginx, but it's like Nginx has this like place where you go and say anything that looks like this in the path, send it here, or, you know, and it can be anything. It could be like send it to disney.com. Mm-hmm.
Hey there, this is Rich. Please pardon this quick interruption. We recently passed an internal milestone of 30,000 listens, and I wanted to take a moment to thank you for the support. I was also hoping to encourage you to head on over to iTunes to leave us a review. Positive feedback and constructive criticism are both incredibly important to us. So give us an idea of how we're doing, and we'll promise to keep publishing new episodes every week. Okay, let's dive back in.
Yeah, so Nginx has a config file. It's nginx.conf by default, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where you specify this. The pattern typically would be something like you'd have a mixture, right? You'd have kind of like normal web static assets like JavaScript and yep. images and CSS, right? That would be served up by Nginx itself. And then you would yep. have perhaps, you know, custom API, a RESTful API service. And that would then be forwarded to the upstream in Nginx. And so, but usually in that case, like you're just, it's on its own ELB, right? That's now as a service. So you just be forward, it would just be, you know, making calls out to this other thing.
Right.
So this is a little bit different in that it's looping back around onto the same load balancer, which is, again, I mean, it kind of hurts to say this out loud, like, but I mean, it's kind of
the problem with it though, you know, the load balancer is there and it's like what it understood, the ELB, what they understood was ports. So just mm-hmm. set it to a different port on the same yeah. load balancer.
Yeah. 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 So it was one of those things where it's like, hey,
I think we literally did that exact thing. Like not even just for Kelsis projects, but all the way back in like 2001 or two at StorPerform, just having hardware load balancers that we would reuse and send stuff back to the hardware load balancer from either Apache or IIS to different ports to get the hardware load balancer to do different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an old trick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it worked. It ended up working pretty well. I did that sure. for, it worked like that for a couple, 2-3 years. Every once in a while, things would kind of get locked up a bit. I mean, I think Nginx got confused, or the load balancer did, or ports or whatnot, and would have to kick things over. But for the most part, it worked pretty well. But then recently, within the last few months, it was like, you know, it's really kind of silly that I'm still doing this on using this technique. It's like ALBs now exist. Like this is like a slam dunk, right? For doing ALBs. So just go ahead and I'm just going to convert this over.
ALBs are application load balancers.
Yeah. Yeah. And ALBs do support things like host-based routing, which is essentially what I had to kind of like jury rig here. This is what I was doing, was basically implementing my own host-based routing. So with ALBs, it's just it's a first-class feature. And so I figured, you know, I'll spend, you know, a couple of days doing this or whatnot. And man, I was just blown away by how easy and straightforward this whole process was. And I think start to finish, it took literally like 2 hours. Well, no, maybe not five, but I mean, it felt like 5 minutes, actually. It almost felt like magic.
I had to pay five minutes because it's like a riff on the blog entry. It's like, get your ALB-based, you know, ghost WordPress blog, you know, ghost blog up in 5 minutes or less.
Yeah.
Only my blog post. Yeah. But, you know, what you were doing, because I think we should really point out to sort of the history of MobiCast is like, I think at the time you were literally studying for some AWS certification stuff. And, you know, neither of us are elbow deep in code for our clients. We're often, you know, more at the architecture level, solutions architecture level, and just straight up project management sometimes just to get work done for our clients. So being able to get our hands dirty with something, you know, actual coding or AWS configuration or DevOps, we have to create those opportunities for ourselves.
Yeah.
And this is one of those. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So to convert it over, right? Like I want minimal downtime. I want to make sure that this is a pretty radical different architecture. Just want to make sure that everything's working and whatnot. And so it's like, okay, what are the steps here that I need to do? And so basically, you know, first thing I did, just go create a new ALB and don't worry about the configuration because that comes later, but create my ALB. I then decided to create a brand new ECS cluster as opposed to reusing the existing one. And the reason for that is because I wanted to keep the same service name. I didn't want instead of like my blog too, right? Or my new blog or something like that. I just wanted my blog still, right?
So, right. Not to mention that you get, you know, brand new, fresh AMIs, sure, with the most recent, yeah, template. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I get to, and this whole process of creating an ECS cluster, right, takes literally like 5 minutes.
I said, quick, Rich, what's an AMI?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The acronyms, you're killing me.
I know. So AMI is an application. No. So I don't even know what it is. It's just
AWS machine image, I believe.
AWS machine image. I was like, what's the A stand for? Okay. So it's an EC2 image, basically, Rich. So when I said he would get a new one, what I meant was that those things will kind of get old and they're constantly getting updated with just different capabilities or different versions of the ECS thing, agent. That's the word I was looking for. So by creating a new cluster, he's getting a new ECS AMI that has all the latest features and capabilities.
Indeed. Okay, yes. Continue. So once I have my new ECS cluster created, then I create a new ECS service to host this blog. And so here's the big thing here that I did is make sure that I'm going to use dynamic port mapping, right? And so this is a great feature of ALBs. This is exactly what I wanted. So in the past, I had to kind of keep that map of, for a particular service, what port was it going to listen to? Because again, you can't have more than one service listening to the same port. Yet they all, you have no idea what services are going to be on which machines and have these conflicts. So you have to map. I had to map it myself and manage that mapping. But with dynamic port mapping, you no longer have to do that. You let AWS do it. So it's just a really nice, straightforward, awesome feature. So just check that box. And now
so it's like, this service is going to run on ECS. AWS, I don't care what port it runs on, you figure it out. And then when you point the ALB at the service, you just say, point it at this service name, and AWS knows what port that's running on, or the ALB knows what port that's running on and knows how to get to it. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. So I have a new ECS service. It's going to use dynamic port mapping, and I wire it up and say, this is the ALB that it's using. And then now I can go and configure the ALB. So because now I have the target group, you know, the application, which ends up basically being the target group, if you will, now that that's there. And now I can go into the ALB and I can configure that host base routing. So I can say, okay, for these particular host names, so like for me, it's like the name of my blog is Upstart. So it's like whenever a request comes in and the host name is upstart.chrisick.com, it's going to now forward it to that new ECS service that I just spun up. And then likewise, I can, if I also want like www.chrisick.com to go to that same, I want that to be an alias for it, I just configure that. This is another host forward to this particular ECS service target group. And basically that's all I had to do. And at that point, it's now just a DNS change. So I just go into DNS and now I can say, okay, for upstart.chrisick.com, chrisick.com, point it to this new ALB instead of the old classic load balancer. And now everything just works. And, you know, we just walked through that process. It literally definitely took less than 2 hours. And it simplified everything so much too.
Yeah.
Which was really nice. So, you know, still have just a single load balancer. I can host as basically almost as many services I want. I don't have to manage ports, and it's just very, very simple. And not only that, there's some additional benefits that I get with this as well. So before, with that previous architecture, there's issues with, okay, how do I do TLS correctly? Like, how is that going to work? And how do I handle the redirects there? With the ALB, it's very, very simple because you can just have, you can basically force, I wanted to force all traffic to go over TLS. So all I have to do is just, I can set up the port 80 listener on the ALB, and I can say whenever anything comes in on port 80, just force them to go back through port 443. Mm-hmm. And now, boom, I'm done. I now have all, it's nothing but TLS traffic, and it's all handled at the load balancer level. So that was really, really nice, and just a really easy checkbox to add for functionality.
Yeah. So I think one of the hardest things about ECS is the part that you have to understand how EC2 really works. And that's like setting up your auto-scaling stuff. I can't remember the two names. It's like the auto-scaling something, and then the thing that auto-scaling uses to know what kind of machine it should use when it adds or removes a machine.
Yeah. So when you create an ECS cluster that's backed by an auto-scale group.
Auto-scale group, yeah. Yep.
Auto-scale group is defined by launch configuration.
Launch configuration. I literally was not paying attention to you for about 30 seconds while I was trying to remember the word launch configuration. Thank you for reminding me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I do think that's sort of the part where it's like, hey, this is kind of ugly. But you can get around that by using Fargate if you're just like, scale up or scale down. I don't want to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, truth be told, I mean, you know, all this stuff is all wrapped by AWS ECS to begin with. So it's like if you are using ECS, you just go in and say create cluster to you. It just, and you tell it when you create the cluster how many machines you want in it. And so if you want 3 or whatever like that, it's just setting the number of machines in the autoscale group to 3. It never tells you that it created an ASG, an autoscale group. It never told you it created a launch configuration. You just kind of give it the parameters it needed to go do that. And so I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that they use ECS, they've spun it up, and they don't even know that they have an ASG and a launch configuration behind it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. This also, you know, because I've been thinking a lot about serverless lately, this whole thing makes me realize that, you know, Ghost and then some of the things that Rich was talking about, just CMSs, you gotta think that somebody's maybe working on a serverless CMS, which would be kind of neat. If you wanted to do self-hosting, you could create like a serverless CMS that would unroll itself inside your AWS account, basically grab the CloudFormation to just spin up a serverless CMS inside your AWS account so that you still own all you're in control of all the resources that AWS actually owns the physical hardware of. But mm-hmm. But yeah, kind of slightly different than having to run a Docker image and, you know, do the care and feeding of a Docker image. You could do like a fully serverless thing that can scale down to 0 or scale up to 1,000,000. I bet somebody's working on that.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's probably several, you know,
things underway right now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they exist. I mean, like for like this particular architecture, it's really Ghost is the only thing that can't be serverless.
Right.
Because, like, it supports MySQL, and so we already in the previous episode we talked about Aurora serverless, and so I can use that. You know, we have, so really it's just the hosting of the actual CMS itself. And at the end of the day, like, you can totally see like a CMS being implemented as Lambda functions, right? Mm-hmm. Like for each one of the API calls and manipulating, you know, making database calls and when it needs to and whatnot. And so it's not too difficult to see that path kind of happening. And so I'm sure that it does exist out there.
Yeah, we'll leave it as an exercise for the listener. Go Google it and find out if that's happening. And then whoever does do that, they're like that, whoever's working on that will get that one little extra hit, hopefully get famous.
Yeah, I Googled it. there's a few. CosmicJS.
Oh, yeah, I think I've heard of that.
And Webony is actually one that was on Product Hunt not too long ago.
Oh, interesting.
March.
Yes, CMS is due for, you know, and let me be clear, you know, the architecture of your CMS is not really that important at the end of the day, as long as it can scale. And as long as it can scale quickly, that's the requirement. The business requirement is being able to scale up and scale down quickly, not that it uses AWS in a specific way or Google Cloud or Azure in a specific way, but just that it can do what it needs to do to handle low or high and spiky traffic. So that, you know, and CMS is ripe to be, what's the word, disrupted. So we'll watch it. We'll keep watching it. In the meantime, there's rarely a project that goes by with Kelsis that doesn't require at some level integration with the CMS. So there's always, you know, that connection between marketing and people that want to make changes to what they see on web pages without getting the development team involved, and the stuff that just needs the development team to change it. So yeah.
I feel like CMSs are need to be more of a business decision than a technology decision for that reason, right? Because you need to have the marketing team in there, and they're going to be comfortable with the UI, and they're going to be uncomfortable with new UIs. And so I think WordPress ends up being the choice, not for the tech stack. I don't think WordPress, at least in the last couple of years,
definitely not the choice for the tech stack. Exactly.
Because people are familiar with it, and the ecosystem is huge. So, like, you know, a lot of problems are already solved in you know, you can pay a license for $100 a year to solve a really hard problem. And when you start to go into those obscure CMSs that are still in their infancy, like you typically are building everything from scratch.
Mm-hmm. And it gets back into that thing I was just saying, like you don't want to get the development team involved on some of these simple things that you're doing on your user-facing website.
Yeah, I think one of my like marketing taglines, if I was to target software engineer companies like Kelsis, would be software engineers should not build marketing websites.
Agreed.
Right? Not that they can't, they shouldn't, right? It's not a good use of your time.
Right. All right, well, thanks, Rich. Thanks, Chris. That was really interesting.
Yeah.
We'll catch you next week.
All right, see you next week. Later.
Well, dear listener, you made it to the end. We appreciate your time and invite you to continue the conversation with us online. This episode, along with show notes and other valuable resources, is available at mobicast.fm/65. If you have any questions or additional insights, we encourage you to leave us a comment there. Thank you, and we'll see you again next week.